right. Greetings and welcome to From the Frontline. And if you're wondering, wait, hang on, this is not the voice that we're used to. You're 100% correct for all of those that tune into From the Frontline and support the podcast and support the channel with Dr. Peter Hammond and Justin Ford. Unfortunately, Dr. Peter Hammond is away on a speaking tour and he's having a great time, I hope, over in the UK and the USA, and we hope to see him back on the podcast in the next sort of 2 to 3 weeks. But for today, you have the Cyber Hitchhiker in studio. That is me, Vaughn, as I'm known as the Cyber Hitchhiker on my digital platforms. And I will be doing a show for you today, and hopefully it's going to be a show like no other. The title of the show is To Be or Not to Be Human. And this is a journey down the gender reclassification rabbit hole. And we're not here to point fingers. We are just here to educate and to bring this a little closer to home here in South Africa. But obviously, in America at the moment, for the last 10 years, they've been going down this rabbit hole. And the descent is getting more and more steep. So, To Be or Not to Be Human, a journey down the gender reclassification rabbit hole. So, let me pose this question. Who knows who Leah Thomas is? I'm pretty sure that for those over in the States, you are very familiar with Leah Thomas, or William Thomas, as I like to call him. But here in South Africa, maybe some people don't know about Leah Thomas. So Leah Catherine Thomas was born in May 1999. Let's call him William Thomas. And he is an American swimmer. He is the first openly transgender athlete to win an NCAA Division I national championship, having won the women's 500-yard freestyle event in 2022. Just to put this into context for you, when he was competing in the male category, he wasn't even ranked in the top 3,000 male swimmers in the country, which means he wasn't even mediocre. But here is Leah Thomas winning an NCAA Division I national championship in 2022, 500-yard freestyle. And during his swimming career, Thomas has been part of a very open public debate about transgender women in women's sports. Now, here is a video that we are going to play. And this video, well, for you guys that are tuning into the podcast, you will hear the audio. And it is a interview between Paige Steele and Riley Gaines, who was a swimmer who competed with Leah Thomas. And she tells the story of how she met him for the first time. So without further ado, let's listen to this interview with Paige Steele and Riley Gaines.
First found out about who this man was in November. He's leading the nation, like dominating, actually not just leading the nation, dominating the entire country of women. I didn't know who it was at first. I see this name, Leah Thomas, and I'm like, hold on. I'm vying for a spot to be, you know, a national champion. I was ranked third in the country at this point in time. And this was in November of 2021.
But which race?
The 200 free.
Yep.
So I was ranked third in the nation, trailing a girl who swam at University of California. She was ranked second. She's now transferred to Florida. That tells you anything.
From
Berkeley to Gainesville. Yeah. She was in second. I knew her very well because, you know, like most sports, your top tier athletes know of each other regardless of where you compete. It didn't matter that she was in California. We'd grown up competing against each other. So I knew her very well. But this swimmer who was leading the nation, of course, I never heard of. I'm looking up this person's name. There's no history of this person except for that season. I mean, none of it made sense. And so I'm scratching my head. I'm talking to my coaches and my teammates. Who is this? No idea. And we really continued to stay in the dark until an article came out that disclosed that Leah Thomas is actually Will Thomas and swam 3 years on the men's team at UPenn before deciding to switch to the women's team, where he was very mediocre. And that's generous.
Right, like 400 and some,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And the 100 freestyle, which he ended up placing top eight in at NCAAs, top eight in the entire country, he wasn't even ranked in the top 3,000 among the men. Okay, so mediocre is generous. So I found out who this person was. I found out it was actually a boy. of course, I knew that was wrong this whole time. We all did. My teammates, we knew the unfair competition was wrong. We knew that having to change in a locker room with him was wrong. We knew that the silencing that we faced from our universities was wrong. We knew all of that. But I will tell you kind of this defining moment for me upon getting to that national championships. I only had to compete against him at one meet. It was like a week-long meet, but I didn't swim in the Ivy League, so I didn't have to go to Ivy Leagues with him. He wasn't on my team, nothing like that. I only competed against him this one meet. So upon getting to that meet, I'm kind of ashamed to admit it, but I was almost intrigued prior to arriving because we had so many questions. Like, it felt like this circus. There was this big buildup about it. We'd already gone to sensitivity training at my school before this to prepare ourselves to learn how to use she, her pronouns. We had already done all of the things to prepare. And so it was kind of like, I had so many questions. Again, we all did. You know, what is the locker room going to look like? Is he as tall as what his Instagram pictures look like?
You guys are looking him up. And
oh, yeah, thinking, yeah. So it's kind of like this sense of intriguement, like, haha, still at this point. And then all those questions were answered. And I felt ashamed for feeling intrigued. I felt heartbroken, really, upon seeing this.
What was your, when you first saw him up close and in person for the first time?
Well, first I had to do this because he's so tall.
He's huge.
He's huge. Wikipedia says he's 6'1", but understand Wikipedia is lying to you. He is 6'4". So, I mean, this Goliath of a man, his feet are huge. Of course, wearing a women's swimsuit with a bulge. Like, there was so much about this where I was just like, oh my gosh.
So what was your reaction when you saw him in person for the first time in a swimsuit?
We were kind of like, me and my teammates, actually the first time I saw him was in the locker room.
Oh.
And so, as I said, which let me just kind of set the scene, a swimming locker room is not a place of modesty. These suits that you put on, your racing suits, it takes about 15, 20 minutes to really poke and prod yourself into these suits. They're paper thin, they're skin tight, your nail beds are bleeding by the end of it. Most of the time you bring gloves so your fingernails don't poke through your suit or so your fingers literally don't bleed because it's so intense. You have friends like helping you try and like tuck skin rolls in your suit, all this stuff. So it's a very intimate, not modest environment. And there's also a lot of course, fully undressing.
Of course.
You get to the pool in your clothes, you change into your warm-up suit, just a normal practice suit. Then after warm-up, you change into your racing suit, which is where, you know, you're really fighting to put this thing on. Then after that, after you race, you come back and you change back into your practice suit to go warm down. Then after that, you come and put your clothes back on. So there's like, I mean, five times of fully undressing in one session. And we had multiple sessions every day to set the scene. So I'm in the locker room. I have my back turned, of course, undressing. I believe I was going from my practice suit back into my street clothes. And all of a sudden, you hear a man's voice in that locker room. Of course, it's awkward. It's embarrassing. It's uncomfortable. It was innate for every single girl in that locker room to like cover themselves, whether it was with their hands or their clothes or their towels, and to leave as quickly as they could. Of course, it's an utter violation. It felt like betrayal. It was traumatizing. And maybe not even necessarily traumatizing because of what we were forced to see or how we were forcibly and non-consensually exploited. It was traumatic for me to know just how easy it was for those people who created these policies to totally dismiss our rights to privacy without even a second thought, without even bare minimum forewarning us that we would be sharing this changing
space.
How
was he handling the tucking himself into a suit? Like, is that, it's all exposed? Like, are you right there witnessing this?
Yeah, so
again, was he getting help from somebody?
I got out of there before I even saw him putting on a women's swimsuit, but a swimming locker room, like it's basically just a big square, like a big open square. There's no like aisles or halls or, I mean, of course there's bathroom stalls, maybe three, but this meet had hundreds of swimmers. So it's not an actual feasible option to get undressed inside of a stall. Like, and let's be honest, locker rooms in general aren't comfortable.
Mm-mm.
But growing up a swimmer, you become comfortable being vulnerable in that environment. But that vulnerability was entirely stripped. And so he kind of just went off and I mean, he was in the wide open and just takes his clothes off. And lo and behold, Thomas and all of his glory are lack thereof. So that's what the experience was like, at least in terms of the locker room. Even one girl who, she's a 31-time All-American. She's amazing. She's one of the most decorated swimmers in all of U.S., really, I mean, world history. She's amazing. Her name's Kylie Alons. She walked out of the locker room, swim at NC State, and I'll never forget. She said she found a janitor's closet to undress in, and she said, I'm so grateful that I found this janitor's closet, and it hit me. Oh my gosh, we are calling this progress, yet Kylie just said she's grateful to undress in a janitor's closet. She's grateful for that closet. This is not progress. Are you kidding me? Progress indicates we're moving in the positive forward direction.
Have you ever talked to him?
Not outside of, no. At that meet, there was, of course, in the ready room and different things.
Sure.
Very brief, small talk, but no, never.
If he walked in here right now.
I'd love it.
Today, what would you say?
I would want him to know that his actions displayed an utter disregard for us as women, which is, of course, what the women's sporting category was created to protect and uphold and celebrate. I would let him know that, look, I have no animosity towards him. I really don't. Like, I don't garner this hatred in my heart. Ultimately, he was following the rules. It's the rules that are the problem. And I would be sure to tell him that. I would be sure to tell him, look, live your life. Be who you want to be. Don't expect me to support it or affirm these delusions that you have, because you very much are a man. And that will never change. I would have no problem saying that to Thomas's face.
You are deliberate in saying Thomas.
I am.
Not Leah.
I am.
And not she, her pronouns, yeah. Which he's Thomas, I struggle, right?
Right.
Says she is. What is behind that?
I thought it was kind and respectful at first to kind of use and adhere to the whole preferred pronouns thing. I thought that's what kindness was. That's what we were told being respectful was. So I believed it. As I said, we had to go to training. We had an outside professional, whatever that means, come in and teach us, sit us down, go through these mock interview questions. We had to answer these questions to her standard before we could pass. And if we didn't, we had to go through the training again. I really believed, okay, no, I don't agree with this, but I can still be kind.
Sure.
That's not what kindness is. I realized that's still pandering. That's still, it felt wrong still. It still went against my gut instinct. And I realized, no, it's kind to say the truth. That's what love is. I'm not saying it to be offensive. I'm not saying it to deliberately hurt someone's feelings. I'm saying it to be authentic and to show that it's okay to use clear language. Our language has been, and this is one of the most eye-opening things I've learned these past 2 years, is how powerful the corruption of our language really is.
So here's the thing. When I grew up playing Cowboys and Indians, never did I ever really think about being a cowgirl. Obviously, I would often think about being maybe the bad guy sometimes, but always the bad guy, not the bad girl. And sometimes I'd want to be the Indians because it would be awesome to use a different weapon. I could use a bow and arrow instead of the normal shotgun and pistol. And I remember occasions when I would even get caught by my mom in the house, and she would laugh because she would walk into her bedroom and she would find her little boy with her high heel shoes on, and maybe I'd have her dress on and maybe a string of pearls around my neck, and obviously looked very funny because everything was so big for me and I couldn't fit into it. The shoes, the dress was too big, the pearl necklace was more like a belt around my waist because I was a small boy. But never did my mom think that maybe I wanted to be a girl. She would even ask me, why do you want to be like me? And my answer was simple, because I love you and I want to be like you because you're such an amazing person. It had nothing to do with me wanting to be a physical woman at all, but more because I was trying to express how much I looked up to my mom and admired her character as a woman and obviously as my mother. Now, today, unfortunately, it's all about genders, or should I say agendas. When I was in my early 20s, I had just turned my back on God, and I remember saying this quite a lot because I thought it would be amusing if it happened, but also because I was curious if you could influence people enough to let this happen. I would ask the question very often in most conversations I had, and I would then theorize over this and would try and look at all the different scenarios that could maybe play out. And you might be asking yourself, well, Vaughn, what was the question you might be thinking? And the question is simple. If the roles were reversed and the majority of the population was crazy, as in clinically psychotic, would the normal people be locked away in institutions and be called crazy? And would the crazy people be walking around free, being called normal? And I used to think about this all the time. Now, this was the late 90s, early 2000s, and never did I ever think that due to the advent of social media and devices that now connect us and give us access to unlimited news and entertainment, would this ever be playing out for real? But it is. And that brings us to what I want to discuss this week. And I want to talk about furries. You could say that this is a bit of an intro because we are doing a panel discussion in a couple of weeks, but I'll discuss that a little bit later and we'll make this available for the guys who tune into the podcast. We'll let you know where you can watch this panel discussion because it will be recorded. And because I'm not an expert in everything and I don't know much about anything, I try and use a lot of data, especially video and studies from those in the know to get my point across. And for those that might think, well, who is this guy anyway? Who is this cyber hitchhiker? Who is Vaughn? Well, I'm currently studying two master's degrees, one in digital marketing, specializing in search engine optimization, and the other in graphic design. I've had the privilege of working for some amazing organizations over the years. I used to work for Doctors for Life International. I was their IT and project manager, helped them basically get them onto the digital spaces, help them set up their social media, help them with all their video editing, help them increase their digital footprint, if I can put it that way. And then obviously I've had the pleasure of being able to work with Frontline Fellowship over the years. I've got my own company called Decent Digital Solutions Pty Limited, where we do web development, app development, search engine optimization, helping guys out with content creation, social media, and everything to do with the digital space. I've had the privilege of being involved with radio for many, many, many years. Good News Community Radio up in Durban in KwaZulu-Natal here in South Africa is one of the places that I have worked on and off over the years. And Tigerberg Radio here in Cape Town, we do a show for them called Salt and Light, which I also host every now and again. And then obviously I've got various podcasts, the Crossfire podcast. You can see that on Spotify. And we've also got a YouTube channel and a Facebook page. And then my various platforms under the Cyber Hitchhiker across all social media. And that's me in a nutshell. But I have a passion for knowledge and for imparting knowledge and for digging deeper into things. And I don't mind sometimes being a little bit controversial. So before we get into furries, let's just speak about global average screen time. And I'm going to bring this closer a little bit to home to South Africa. Global average screen time is roughly 6 hours and 58 minutes every day. And if you guys think that's a lot, it is. And this is not including guys that work with screens. This is your average person, how much screen time they have every day across various devices. 6 hours, 58 minutes is the world average. And for those in South Africa, you might be shocked to know that South Africa is the highest in the world with average screen time. And we have an average screen time consumption of around 10 hours, 46 minutes, almost 4 hours, the global average. And you might go, Vaughn, but that's crazy. Well, yeah, sure, but we do spend a lot of time on our screens. Now, social media stats in South Africa. We have over 30 million active social media users. And just like everywhere else on the planet, social media is growing rapidly in South Africa. In fact, there are now, like I just said, pretty much 30 million plus active social media users in the country because it's growing daily. And this number is expected to increase exponentially over the next few years. How much time do South Africans spend on social media then if we're on our screens for 10 hours a day? The short answer is a lot, and you might be surprised to learn that South Africa ranks fourth in the world in terms of total time spent online per day, that is using social media. And the figures are astonishing. The average South African spends over 52,000 minutes. Yes, that is correct. 52,000 minutes on social media each year. That's about 36 days and 18 hours a year in total. How many South Africans are online, you might ask? Because we are a developing nation. We are a third world country. As of January 2022, there were an estimated 41.19 million South Africans that were using the internet. Now, to put that in context, we've only got a population of 60 million. So it's way more than half of the people have complete access to the internet. And to put that into context for you again, back in 2000, which was only 22 years earlier, we only had 2.4 million people that were online and had access to the internet. Now it is over 40 in 20 years. That is exponential growth. I always talk about legacy, and this is why I do the things that I do. And I always speak about the now generation. I'm not interested in the future generations or the past generations or any other generations. I'm interested in our generation today, the Gen Zs, the youth. And we clearly have, obviously, as far as I'm concerned, lost the plot as those who are supposed to be imparting our knowledge for future generations and raising up a chosen generation. And let's have a look quickly to see why it is so important for us to teach our youngest well and to lead by example. The best thing that we can do is be a positive influence, and not just a positive influence. We need to do this through discipleship, which means taking ownership, being a part of our youth and imparting the knowledge and training them, that this will help them through life. And this includes social media, guys. We need to be involved with social media with our youth. Now, we're going to look at some shocking stats here, because when I was researching this, this absolutely blew my mind. Have to have a good big mug of coffee when you're doing a lengthy podcast like this. So let's look at it like this. Since 2000, how much has depression increased amongst the Gen Zs in the last 23, 24 years? So between 2009 and 2017, depression rates increased significantly among Gen Zs. And here are some of the key statistics. Amongst adolescents aged 12 to 13, depression rates increased around 47%. For teens aged 14 to 17 years old, the increase was even more pronounced at around 60%. Young adults aged 18 to 21 years old also experienced a 46% increase in depression rates. Additionally, a 2018 survey found that 70% of teens aged 13 to 17 years old considered anxiety and depression a major problem among their peers. The COVID-19 pandemic has further impacted mental health, with Gen Z adults aged between 18 and 23 reporting the highest levels of stress and symptoms of depression during this time. Now, since 2000, how much has anxiety increased amongst the Gen Zs? And this is where we have to start putting technology into the picture. Technology and mental health. Gen Zs born after 1995 have grown up with smartphones. They've got social media and other digital technologies. And these tools have transformed their lives, but also come with a massive mental health implication. Companies, unfortunately, that have developed these technologies have neglected to do the proper research on their mental health effects, leading to a lot of harm for young people. Social media platforms, video games, and pornography sites have had varying impacts on different genders, with social media affecting girls a lot more significantly. Now, let's look at some statistics and trends. Rates of depression, psychological distress, and suicidal thoughts have increased over the past decade, especially among teens and young adults, Gen Zs. Anxiety is now the most pressing mental health concern amongst college students, with a 39% of millennials even reporting increased stress in the last year. Post-graduation fear of the unknown, influenced by technology use and social media effects such as FOMO, which is a real thing, the fear of missing out, and social comparison pressures. All of this contributes to anxiety disorders amongst our Gen Zs and college students. Anxiety has risen significantly amongst the Gen Zs due to various factors, and this includes technology and societal pressures. Now, let's look at suicide, guys. We have to. You can't leave suicide out. Since 2000, how much has suicide increased amongst Gen Zs? Now, this is the one that shocked me the most, if I have to be honest for you. So let's break it down. Between 2007 and 2013, the suicide rate for young people was at around 3% per year. However, from 2013 to 2017, in the next 4 years or 5 years, that number shot up by almost 7% per year. The suicide rate amongst people aged 10 to 24 increased by 56% between 2007 and 2017, according to a report by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And let's look at some age-specific trends with suicide. For children aged 10 to 14, the suicide rate tripled between 2007 and 2017, after years of decline. Among teens aged 15 to 19, the rate increased by 76%. And that is insane. 76% increase in suicide rates between kids aged 15 to 19. Gen Zs versus millennials. Gen Zs born during 1997 onward might be facing mental health crisis even worse than that experienced by the older millennial generation. Since 2014, millennials, those aged between 23 to 38 by 2019, have seen a 47% increase in major depression diagnoses. For Gen Zs, the mental illness crisis continues. In 2017, 13% of teens reported having experienced at least one major depressive episode in the past year, compared to only 8% when more millennials were teens back in 2007. Social media, which Gen Z uses extensively, may contribute to this increase in mental illness. Overuse of social media can cause loneliness, depression, and anxiety. Doesn't sound very social, does it? And I'm not knocking social media, guys, because I am in digital marketing and I use social media to its fullest. A 2023 CDC study revealed that the Gen Zs face a mental health crisis, obviously during the pandemic, and homicide rates hit a 25-year high. And the suicide rate was the worst in over 50 years. This is absolutely insane. Gen Z faces a mental health crisis. And this is no joke. It is a serious, serious issue. Which brings me back to furries, and or furries, I should say. And let me just drop this in here quickly. ADHD presentations and podcasts and hearing me talk on radio and other digital platforms is never boring. Because I never ever move in a straight line. So I'm always keeping the guys on their toes. But what is the deal with furries? I mean, what even is a furry? And we're going to get into this. Now, a decade of research reveals a lot about the subculture. And according to this survey, which obviously is a biased survey, says that this is a very misunderstood subculture. And we're going to go deeper into this. But I'll leave it up to you to decide if they really are misunderstood. I mean, all of this info comes from a Dr. Courtney Plante, P-L-A-N-T-E. And this is a social psychologist and the co-founder of the International Anthropomorphic Research Project. Anthropomorphic is basically an animal with human features, enlarged eyes, normally looks very, very cute, but doesn't have to be. And he put together a team of international social scientists, and they studied what they call the furry fandom. And he's also the lead author of a compendium of findings from studies on this very furry fandom. So you might know them as the people who dress up in these giant animal mascot costumes. Or depending on the media you consume, you may also know them as the people who think they're animals and have a weird fetish for fur. Regardless of what you have or have not heard about furries, it might surprise you to learn that there is a team of researchers, like I've said, who have devoted their careers to studying this fandom. Perhaps even more surprising is what nearly a decade of research on the subject can tell us about how we relate to animals, how we understand ourselves, and how we benefit from letting our inner child run wild every so often. Or just as likely, you've also heard the term furry before, outside the context of your pet and dog, obviously, when you often see that neighbor that is mowing the lawn on a Saturday morning without the shirt on and they've got a serious amount of back hair. Very, very furry. Now, please remember, all of this is me quoting Dr. Courtney Plaint, and this is from that 10-year study, so this is not me sounding like I'm fur furries or I'm for them or against them. I'm just giving you his information first, and then we're going to dissect. Demographically, the furry fandom is comprised of predominantly white males in their teens to mid-20s, and for the most part, they represent what you would expect to find in a typical geek or nerd subculture. Above-average school performance, interest in computers, science, passion for video games, science fiction, fantasy, and obviously anime. Less typically known, however, and this is where we are going to go into it, is the fandom's LGBTQ demographics. Furries are 7 times more likely than the general population to identify as transgender, and about 5 times more likely to identify as non-heterosexual. I wonder why that is. Given this composition, it should come as no surprise that the furry fandom is a community defined in no small part by its inclusivity. This fandom embraces the norms of being welcoming and non-judgmental to all. Sounds super-duper friendly. Now, the vast majority of furries create what they call a fursona, and this is a furry-themed avatar used to interact with other members of the fandom, and fursonas typically consist of one or more animal species that can be put together with a name and personality traits or characteristics to match this made-up animal. Now, given the fantasy-themed nature of the furry fandom, individual furries are free to create representations of themselves unbounded by reality. As such, they can conceptualize themselves with regard to age, gender, personality, or physical characteristics. They can change all of it, either up or down when it comes to age. So you might have, underneath that costume, a middle-aged man pretending to be a young boy or a young girl, or the other way around. Research has shown that most furries create personas representing similar but very idealized versions of themselves. And many furries report that over time, their own self-concept tends to become more like that of the persona. And this may be due to the fact that over time, others begin to interact with them as this idealized self, validating it and helping them to internalize it as part of themselves. Now, many furries describe the fandom as one of the first places where they felt like they could belong. Something that needs to be contextualized with the fact that furries are about 50% more likely than the average person to report having been bullied during childhood. They face trauma. For most furries, the fandom is about more than just indulging a childlike fantasy every once in a while. It is about forging lifelong friendships and building a social support network in a community who will not judge them for having unconventional interests. Now, there was a study done here in South Africa that was part of a master's thesis, and it's called A Critical Reflection on Youth That Identify as Furries in South Africa. And I'll give you a bit of the abstract of the study. So youth is a broad developmental age range marked by contextual and behavioral risk factors. Marginalized youth cohorts may be additionally at risk. International studies indicate that furries, briefly defined by their interest in anthropomorphic animals, may be one such cohort. However, little is currently known about furries in the South African context. Using the social identity approach as a theoretical underpinning, this article draws on research that formed part of a broader master's dissertation mixed methods study. Firstly, using quantitative analysis, this article presents the demographic prototype of furries collected from 98 furries by the means of the ZA Fuzzbutts SFW group chat, which is on Telegram, and the ZA Furries online, or ZA Furries online forum. This demographic profile provides the first empirical data to map a prototypical profile of the South African furry. Now let's listen to a very short furry interview that was done in South Africa by a prominent YouTuber, and they met online in the metaverse or in the virtual space using virtual reality and using VR headsets in order to speak to each other.
Look, are you rocking the whole VR chat furry avatar?
Guys, clearly never heard of incognito mode.
How you doing, dude?
I'm good, man. You?
No, good, good. Your video is really good, by the way. It's like really top quality, bro.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that. So you ready to get started?
No, I'm all good, bro.
All right. So what's it like living in South Africa?
I live in the suburbs, just outside the cities. So we've got three provinces. We've got three like major, you know, cities. We've got Cape Town, Durban, and Joburg, which is kind of like in a triangle, if you look at it in that way. And I live in the middle. So a large part of KZN is pretty much just, I think for you guys in America, you call it rural land. When you learn in geography, it's rural. You got the city, and Durban City isn't anything pretty. It's pretty nasty, if I'm being honest. And then outside of it is just all rural, like, you know, suburbs and their own little like villages. But when I say villages, it's more like built up, like legit civilized. Like it's all civilized. It's just not a city. It's not like you guys have in America. You guys have like huge cities and huge towns. It's like we have, you know, lots of suburban areas. It's very different from over in the States compared to here.
And you've lived there all your life?
Yeah, born and raised South African. I was born in KwaZulu-Natal.
So is Africa portrayed as it is in media, or is it a bit more developed?
I mean, the power goes out like every day, at least 2 hours at a time. My power's went out twice today. We have load shedding. It's like it has high crime and, you know, the usual shit that, you know, is portrayed with the South African memes. Yeah, I mean, I've been hijacked. I've been put at gunpoint. I mean, it's South Africa. It is what it is. Crime's really high, but it's a beautiful place. I mean, if you go to the right places, I mean, it's like anywhere, right? You know, there's some nice places and then some sketchy places.
So how did you get into this?
Oh, right into it. I found some spicy stuff. No, but through animations, I guess, like Disney animations. I think the first one would have been probably Treasure Planet with the stepdad being a dog.
So what do you enjoy doing?
I used to surf. I used to make surfboards and ride motorcycles.
What do you do for work?
I stream. Stream and content creation, being a goof on the internet.
And you do avatar texturing too, right?
Yeah, for avatar textures. Yeah, this is my avatar. The way I see it, like content creation just covers like all of it. So like videos, streams, avatars, pretty much everything, dude. Anything and everything that has to do with VR chat, I try to use it. Cool. To my fullest ability.
So are there a lot of furries in South Africa?
That's an interesting question, because if you'd asked me that same question a year ago or 2 years ago, I would have said, no, there's not many furries here. But just in the last year, I've met more furries than I have in the last, like, 4 years.
Right, so now that we've listened to that interview, let me ask you guys the question. Are furries sexual in nature? And this is what a survey at the Furry Fiesta found in 2013. It found that 96.3% of male respondents and 78.3% of female ones reported viewing furry pornography. Yes, you heard me correctly, furry pornography. Men reported looking at furry porn at least 41.5 times per month and on average, while women reported looking at it around 10.5 times per month on average. Men reported spending around 34% of their online role-playing time on sexual content, and women reportedly spending only around 21.4%. So this should answer our question whether furries are, or furries are sexual or not. Now, I came across something while I was doing this research that really freaked me out, because My Little Pony, for those that remember My Little Pony, my sister used to love My Little Pony when she was a small girl, is a kiddies program. And there is a whole movement, which is sort of part of the furry fandom, but also separate, and they call themselves bronies. So are furries the same thing as bronies? So let me just first, if you're like me and you went, what on earth is a brony? Bronies refer to exclusively to fans of a very specific My Little Pony show called My Little Pony Friendship is Magic. Originally, it only referred to male fans, but they can't anymore, so they've broadened the definition. And bronies share one basic commonality with furries. They are interested in anthropomorphized representations of animals, but it has to center around the My Little Pony kiddies show, animated kiddies show. Now, here's the thing, guys. 23.19%, that's almost a quarter of the furry fandom, say that they are Christian. And this shocked me. How can this be possible? How can it be that furries can, one in every four, say that they are Christian and mean it? Well, here's the thing. The world has a different view on Christianity to what the Bible says a Christian is. Now, let's listen to an audio clip from a prominent YouTuber, for those that are on the podcast, and for those that will be watching the videos, you guys will be able to watch the video. But let's listen to this from a prominent YouTuber named Benny Johnson, who's followed by many Christians and people that consider themselves conservative. And let's just get one thing straight. Conservative and Christian is not the same thing. Christianity, true Christianity, is actually not conservative at all. So let's listen to this short clip.
Welcome to a historic location, the only In-N-Out Burger that's ever closed. This location, because there were over 1,000 robberies in the drive-thru lane. One police report has a series of two suspects that were robbing people, going car to car, robbing people as they waited for their burgers in In-N-Out. Another police report had a homeless gang of fentanyl heads that just came marauding through and stealing people's food. This depressing living memorial to the shittiness of California progressive Democrats. The police here in California have had their balls cut off and have no capacity to actually do any police work. And so people feel, what?
In the middle of filming, we heard a loud smash. You guessed it. We were the next statistic.
What just happened here? Is my backpack gone? Oh, dude, are you serious?
Luckily, we had ALX inside of the car, and ALX physically fought off the robbers by saying, give me the f***ing bag and get the f*** out of my car.
Am I just broken?
Serious?
Yeah.
100% serious. Wrestled this bag from his f***ing arm.
Did you see the guy?
He had a f***ing black mask on. No, that's all I saw.
Oh my God.
They pulled up right there in a car. He got out of the other, out of the back seat, smashed the window, tried to get this bag, rustled it away, and then I said, get the f*** off. And then he ditched.
Holy f***. Okay, so we just got broken into, I guess, there you go. We're talking about these policies. Here are these policies. So we just proved exactly why In-N-Out shut down. In-N-Out burgers and cups and bags have Bible verses on them because the family is Christian, family, great Americans, and great patriots. It's John 3:16. That is the salvation verse about Jesus Christ. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, for whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. And unfortunately, In-N-Out doesn't have eternal life here in California.
Now, for those that heard this and for those that will be watching the video, what was wrong with that video? Did you guys pick up anything? Yes, for me, it would definitely be the way Benny Johnson speaks. The words that come out of his mouth are filthy, and he does not sound like a Christian, although he was quoting John 3:16 at the end of the video. Now, let's ask another question. Do furries, these guys that dress up in these mascot costumes, actually think that they are animals? About 1 in 3 furries report feeling not 100% human. A small fraction, 8 to 14, report 8 to 14% report meaning this in a very physical sense, with many more stating they feel not fully human mentally or spiritually. About 38 to 53% report a desire to be 0% human. That is right. They wish they weren't human. If they could be, they would not be human. That is 38 to 53%. Now, here's the thing that most people don't talk about. Some researchers have suggested that these people could have a species identity disorder, a psychological disorder, which is modeled very much on the gender identity disorder, which is used by psychiatrists to classify trans people. And many trans people argue that the classification of gender dysmorphia or even gender dysphoria as a disorder is stigmatizing and counterproductive. This is a DSM classified mental condition. Well, let me ask you this question. Surely a crazy person most of the time will tell you that they're not crazy. I mean, go figure. And most of us can see that they are crazy, but yet they will tell you that they're not. Now, I hope for those that are listening in and for those that are going to be watching the videos, you can see where I'm going with all of this, hopefully. Now, in the USA at the moment, there's been quite an uproar and quite a few stations and news outlets that have been reporting on this. And that is, there are school children who are now wearing their furry suits to school and identifying as their furry personas. And this is being looked at as healthy and normal. While the normal kids who are protesting because they are being harassed and even bitten by these furries are looked at as being the crazy ones. So let's look at a few clips and listen to the audio of a couple of the radio interviews that have gone on regarding this and what the kids that were protesting have to say.
So are they wearing a mask every day?
Yes!
But every time they go, they're always just wearing a mask, but the principal finally stood up and banned those stuff.
But they still wear them every day.
Yeah, they don't get in trouble. The principal doesn't get to make them get in trouble.
Yeah. All the principal says is just be kind, be nice.
And then...
What's the point of dressing up like a furry?
They think they're so cool that they want to get a lot of attention.
So people can come at them and just look at them and think that they're so cool.
Okay.
Also,
are you guys going to be in trouble for walking out of school today?
We will get in trouble.
Do
your parents know you guys are out here?
Yes!
Okay. They attack us!
If they bite us and we just kick them, we get in trouble!
They attack us and we get in trouble!
Honey, how else do they attack you guys?
They bite us, they scratch us, they hurt us, and then they run on all fours and pounce on all fours.
A teacher from Mount Nebo Middle School contacted me and said this has been happening for over a year, and this one is actually really sad, and this person needs to be reprimanded. Rebecca Hunsaker Barney said, "This is the school I work at. I'm embarrassed for the parents that just believed everything their kids told them, then staged a protest without even contacting the school to find out what is really happening. The truth is that a few kids dress as pets stay to themselves. They do not do any of these things these kids are reporting. However, they are constantly picked on and bullied." So the kids stay to themselves, but what about the video I just got from a concerned parent where this girl acting like a dog is going after these students? This gets even better. "Honestly, we had the most wonderful, peaceful day yesterday because most of the troublemakers were out protesting a lie." Really? Because that doesn't look like a lie. "The halls were quiet and actually cleaner without them there. This is a teacher at the school. This teacher's supposed to look at these kids in the eye, unbiased, and give them grades."
This is Strudel, a member of the furry fandom. Though they've been a furry for over a decade, they have their own opinions.
"It's crazy that it's escalated to this point where these kids are being so distracting to their peers that their peers want to stage a walkout. So to have, you know, the next generation kind of muddy our name and not represent it very well, it is kind of disappointing."
Strudel believes there should be some limits.
"Continue doing things you like, continue dressing up, continue making art, but maybe let's keep it outside of school hours.
According to WebMD, a furry is someone who has an interest in animals with human qualities and who sometimes dresses up as a cartoon-like version of an animal. Quote, I really like the idea of animals that walk and talk, so I'm going to dress up as one as kind of a fun sort of cosplay thing, Strudel said. WebMD said people are often interested in becoming furries to find a sense of community, though some of the drawbacks they may face are negative stereotypes and social stigmas. Now, I have no idea why WebMD is being consulted for furry information, but in any event, it implies that the negative stereotypes and social stigmas against this quote-unquote community are wrong, but they aren't. I mean, there should be a social stigma attached to walking around in a ridiculous costume.
Right, use that time to have a bit of a coffee, but I hope you guys enjoyed those clips. Now, here in South Africa, we have a well-known rugby player, Cobus Visa. And he stirred up quite a bit of controversy recently with something that he wanted to do. And he recommended what he called a gender swap day. And this was reported in one of our local newspapers here in Cape Town called the Cape Town Today. And he announced this gender swap day at a South African elementary school where boys would dress as girls and girls would dress as boys. Now, being a very manly, macho kind of guy, ex-World Cup winning rugby player, this surprising revelation provoked a range of reactions, with many expressing skepticism and disbelief. The initiative raises questions about the future of gender norms here in South Africa and education. And with Cobus Visa being a legendary former Springbok, he used the platform X, formerly known as Twitter, to divulge a rather unusual piece of news. And that was, let's have a gender swap day in school. And guess what? A few schools had gender swap days. And I've watched a few videos and seen the pictures. And it is actually horrifying to see that this is not even well-to-do private schools, but some of our very rural schools out in the rural areas that have classrooms that are falling apart. They are having a gender swap day, and even some of the teachers decided to join in and dress as the opposite sex to school. So I'm going to play a few videos now and the audio for those that are tuning into the podcast, because it's important to hear from the inside what is going on. And here is a whistleblower who's made big news over in America at the moment, shedding light on actually what goes on inside a gender reassignment clinic. This lady worked at a trans clinic. She is not anti the movement or trans agenda, but listen very carefully to what she says after becoming a whistleblower, because she was so horrified and shocked. Now, she's a medical professional. She knows what she's talking about. And she sheds light on what goes on in these gender reassignment clinics for children in the USA. Let's take a listen.
So, talk to us, you know, just at the very beginning of that journey. You get there, I'm sure you're all pumped and ready to go. And what happens?
Right away, I was struck by the lack of organization for the center. So there was no real written protocols. It seemed like it was kind of a fly by the seat of the pants kind of operation. They had already been open for a solid year before I got there. And yet it seemed like they were kind of operating outside of a lot of the normal structures that you'd see in medicine. Most of the departments and divisions in medicine have a lot of layers. There's a lot of top heavy, there's a lot of, you know, administrative roles. And it seemed like this center was kind of off on its own, had this little pocket. And I was also struck at the very beginning because the administration of this hospital let this clinic open. And I was told that they originally thought that they were going to have about 50 patients total. And when I left, we were close to 2,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Huge difference.
Wow. And why do you think that was, Jamie? What do you think were the reasons for that?
I definitely have come to believe that in the United States, there is an element of social contagion in play going on with young people who are seeking out care in gender centers. And I'm not the only one to believe that. I had lots of parents report very similar things. And there were even a number of patients in the center who would report and directly said, I only got this online.
Wow. So they only got this online, because your article is very interesting, because you talk about when you started in the center, it was mainly boys suffering from gender dysphoria. And then you started to see more and more girls come in. Were they the ones who were particularly susceptible to this social contagion, as you put it?
I think it's well known in medicine that adolescent girls are just more open and more susceptible to many different kinds of social contagions. Mm-hmm. That has to do with a lot of ways that girls are socialized, but also the way that girls interact in kind of group settings and pick up things and show empathy with those in their group setting, oftentimes by taking on attributes in those group settings. So I didn't just see that these kids were picking up gender as a social contagion. We have a lot of issues right now in my country with adolescents who are experiencing tic disorders. They think they have Tourette's. There's been a recent wave of young people believing that they have what they refer to as DID, so multiple personalities. You are seeing these things directly coming from social media.
And Jamie, can I ask you a question? And sorry to sort of appear picky, but before you started talking about how adolescent girls have certain problems, you kind of did like a little sigh, almost like you're resigning yourself to having to say, was part of your experience that even that very idea was controversial in the environment that you were operating in?
So you'll have to remember that in some ways I am deprogramming my language out of some cult-like conversations. So even for me, I still take pause in using the phrase adolescent girls, because when you work in a place like this, you don't say that. You say people are assigned female at birth. You don't say people are boys. You say they are assigned male at birth. So even the way that we spoke about everybody was in this framework of the gender ideology world.
Wow. So I know that to you, this seems kind of like normal, but to a person outside of that space, just to clarify, in this transgender clinic, you would never refer to people as boys or girls or men or women. You would say assigned female at birth.
That's transphobic to do so.
Wow.
Okay.
But even though biological sex is obviously real.
Oh, yes. Medicine is really interesting in this right now, because in some ways, all of the doctors would clearly acknowledge biological sex. You would say someone was assigned female at birth, assigned male at birth. Maybe you could use natal sex. They acknowledged its existence, because if you're in the emergency room and you have somebody who's coding and you're trying to figure out, what their lung capacity is, there are definite medical needs and times when your biological sex changes the course of the treatment. But in our patient population, everyone was assigned female at birth, assigned male at birth. You heard the term cis a lot. Who's cisgender? We talked about how all of our patients were probably, would judge you if you walked in and they thought you were cis. Those kind of things. It's constant.
And Jamie, how did this affect this type of language? How did this affect the way that you treated your patients?
I do think that the staff were always sort of on edge, because it wasn't just the concern that you were providing good medical care, but you also always had the concern, has this patient's pronouns changed again? Their preferred names were changing frequently. Even the term preferred name, sometimes people would say that's, you know, activists would push that you can't even say that because it's not their preference. It's their name, even though it's not their legal name. A lot of the staff that are hired into the clinics like this, at least in the United States, are also activists, and oftentimes directly, there's a push to directly hire trans and LGBTQIA people to work in these clinics as the staff.
And so you join the clinic, you start working, you start noticing some of these things. And when did you start to get really concerned? Because you were the person responsible for processing the intake of potential Yes. patients. So you're getting these people in and going, you go here, you go there. When did you feel like, whoa, like this is not good?
It was a slow process to get there. There definitely was a point where I went from 10 intakes a month, where there would be 10 newly referred young people, to the numbers being in the 40s and 50s every single month. And the cases were getting more and more outlandish, or sometimes even completely bizarre. In the States, oftentimes, if anything about gender gets brought up in a pediatrician's office, they immediately just refer you to the gender center. So I could be getting an intake where a kid maybe told their parent 3 days ago that they thought they were non-binary and asking for they, them pronouns. And yet they're already landing in a specialized medical clinic that does hormones. So there were some intakes where it was just, it made absolutely no sense. The entire concept of kids being allowed to explore their gender and explore these concepts have been almost wiped off the map.
And what would happen? Let's say I bring my 12-year-old daughter to you. 3 days ago, she said that she's non-binary. She wants they, them pronouns. What happens to her from there?
So initially, I would try to be encouraging you as a parent to find a therapist and start working with a therapist for your kid. But the minute you're talking to me on the phone, you have already started on a pathway. Because the only therapists that I have to refer your kid to are therapists who are going to affirm their gender identity, not question it at all. And potentially, as soon as I say, take your kid to that therapist might see them for one or two visits and send them right back to the center to get started and seen by the people that prescribe hormones.
So 3 days ago, my daughter said, I think I'm non-binary, because she saw it on social media, let's say. I bring her to you. You send us to a therapist. Therapist sees us a couple of times, sends us back to you in order to see a doctor to be prescribed hormones?
Potentially, yes.
Now, what do you say to that? She basically says it all. And for me, I can get quite emotional about it, because it's not in an angry way, but in a very sad way, where I almost want to cry, because this is that chosen generation, that now generation that I keep talking about, that we are throwing away. And for those that are in the know and understand what is going on, what are we doing about it? Are we just being hateful and pointing fingers, or are we actually allowing ourselves to spread the right message in order to help these kids? Now, here is a prominent TikTok guy, and he's made headlines in America again because he's come out against gender-affirming care. And he went down the rabbit hole of gender-affirming care, and he tells you quite candidly in this live stream that he did on TikTok where it started, how he went through the whole process, and where he ended up now at the end of this journey down this rabbit hole. So let's listen to what this young man has to say, where he literally wore his heart on his sleeve during this live stream. and left it all hanging in the air. So let's hear this guy.
Where to begin the story? I think that there were certain aspects of me psychologically and my temperament that made me susceptible. I was raised in a religious household, and it all pales in comparison to discovering online erotica, and that happened at the age of 9, which would eventually lead to pornography. At the age of 12, I started cross-dressing. And so all of those things combined and built up for years, that was starting to cause issues with my self-esteem, with my peers, the things that I would later refer to as gender dysphoria. I have even thought that it was kind of a fear of exposure that I would later refer to as gender dysphoria, because it caused so much anxiety. And this, you know, I've written about this recently, where I went right back to that first time when I started cross-dressing, and I kind of uncoupled a just totally normal, like, procreative urge. But it got twisted up because of the fact that I felt like I had to keep it a secret and hold on to something and possess something, and then getting lost within myself. That was underneath the surface. And already by the age of 16, I was exposed to queer theory and queer activism, this education thing where they passed out these little, the different spectrums of your sex, your gender identity. I got the whole rap. And so by the time I was in senior year, I was already starting to advocate for that ideology myself. When I went to college, all of those underlying issues kind of boiled over, caused so much anxiety and self-esteem issues, and that in turn affected my academic performance. Eventually, I dropped out with this like kind of desire to transition. I remember the drive home from university was this wild trip where I didn't stop. I drove from Tennessee to Oregon without stopping, and I drove through a crazy storm. And in the middle of this blizzard, a story came on NPR about coming out and transitioning and how it was worth it. And I heard that story on the radio, and I was like, I gotta do it. I can do it. So I came home and fell in with a crowd of other kids that I went to high school with who were very brilliant, also getting into non-binary and queer stuff. And that was a crowd of people that would eventually peer pressure me into going to a gender clinic, where I was diagnosed with gender dysphoria in a single visit. The clinic was called Transactive. The clinician was a transgender woman. And I was coached through, these are the things you're going to need to say in order to get this prescription. I started the cross-sex hormones when I was 20 years old, and there was just no gatekeeping at the front. I saw an endocrinologist. You know, I was really concerned about my fertility at the beginning. I kept bringing it up, and I was told repeatedly that the hormones are reversible. I was going to a therapist, and they also kind of encouraged me to deconstruct my thinking about adoption and what counts as a legitimate family. So I had a pretty rocky start to the beginning of my transition. It was making things so much worse. It was making things worse with my family, with my friends. But whenever that would come up in therapy, that was blamed on societal transphobia. And the solution, I've looked at the notes, the solution was like to make the world less transphobic. I got like laser hair removal, and that helped me pass, you know. So I had the hair on my face removed, and started doing my eyebrows. I went to Portland, and there's just all these social services geared towards LGBTQ youth, where I was given free clothes, breast forms. There were trans and queer social workers encouraging me to change my name, my ID, everything. So my whole transition and livelihood ended up being supported by social services. I was housed through these groups. I was provided with friends, with vacation and other queer locations. I transitioned for like 4 or 5 years. I began meeting other trans women and trans feminine people, and I fell into a crowd where a lot of the men had had their testicles removed. And that was kind of sold to me because I didn't have any desire for genital surgery, but these other men were removing their testicles and then saying that this was like a healthier way to transition. They didn't really want the vaginoplasty. They weren't sure. They didn't want to commit to the binary, but if they remove their testicles, then they could feminize more easily. They didn't have to take the spironolactone. out in the woods in these kind of anarchist camps that I would stay at, there were older trans women that were creating their own estrogen therapy with like herbs. They put the idea in my head of the orchiectomy, which is eventually what happened to me. I had made some attempts at detransitioning right at the end. And then just a lot happened. I aged out of the homeless youth continuum. I lost my housing. I was going through this terrible spiral, and the hospital had me on their list and they got me. So I ended up having breast implants inserted, covered on Medicaid, and also an orchiectomy on Medicaid. And like within a month of the orchiectomy, I was suicidal with regret. And I told myself at the same time, it's like I regretted it, but I thought, I don't regret it. I was still locked into the transgender ideology. And I believe that regret was part of being transgender. So I regretted it. As Jane Austen might say, I regretted it, but I didn't repent. I think she says things like that. I read Emma. But so I ended up catching COVID, which is what forced me to move back into my parents' house. And it just totally immobilized me. And that's what it took for it just to start falling away. And I woke up, the destruction of my testicles was just too much of the movement to ask of me. I found the Gender Wider Lens podcast, and that was part of what helped me. And a little bit of Twitter was good at helping unpack the ideology. And then I had to get off Twitter. I'm very glad I did that. I started to journal intensively. And I had just a wonderful self-discovery, finding my values. Just, I'm so grateful I was able to reconnect with my grandmother and my grandfather in the last years before they died. So I ended up being a caretaker for my grandmother and my grandfather. I'm so grateful that I got to be with them. And I journaled all the way through that, just having these kind of self-discoveries, the unpacking the ideology. There's some very extreme grieving going on. I no longer take the word PTSD and trauma so lightly after having bodily damage, because I would wake up screaming, remembering the surgery. I'd wake up screaming no, because I went into surgery with a kind of awareness that I was going to regret it. I would jump out of bed having flashbacks, and I went through very extreme grieving. It was really hard, but I started testosterone replacement therapy in January. It would be months before I could afford to get the breast implants out. But by July of 2021, I was back in the workforce. I've been caring for my family since. It feels great. I'm a machine operator in the cannery where my parents met. My mom's family, because they're farmers, it's like I have a family connection to the place. I've been working there for 2 years now, and I'm getting involved in a community college for automotive technology, which just feels really good. It's rewarding. I have a Substack where I've written about these things that I'm processing. And I'm also working on a memoir where I can get a little bit deeper into the psychology of what led me to transition in the first place. So that's my story.
And that again, for me, is it's difficult to even, you know, carry on with the podcast and for those that are watching the video after watching something like that, because I mean, what do you say? And this is just one story, and this is absolutely insane. It is heartbreaking. Now, this is another clip from a much longer a presentation that was given at a conference in Miami, the National Conservative Conference. And this is a psychologist who I've spoken to personally, and we'll be interviewing in the near future when she's available. She can't do interviews at the moment in South Africa due to certain circumstances. But Dr. Miriam Grossman is a woman I have the utmost respect for and is a leader in her field and one of the top professionals in psychiatry worldwide. And here she speaks quite candidly about gender ideology and the medical experiment on our children at this convention in Miami. Let's take a listen to what Dr. Miriam Grossman has to say.
Not too long ago, the parents that I saw in my office were concerned about the hookup culture and friends with benefits. They worried that their teen daughters might get pregnant or infected with herpes. Those were the good old days. Now the parents that I see are asking me for Xanax, for their panic attacks and insomnia. Their daughters want to grow beards and have their breasts removed. I am reporting to you from the front lines of the war on gender ideology. I am not a journalist, I am not an academic, and I am not part of a think tank. I am a medical doctor who's in the trenches, helping families with children who believe their bodies are terrible mistakes. Some of my patients wear tight elastic binders to flatten their developing breasts. They go through the day in pain, feeling lightheaded and short of breath. Many of my male patients shave their chests, arms, and legs to erase signs of masculinity. Forgive me for being graphic. One 15-year-old patient tapes his penis between his legs and pushes his testicles up into his inguinal canals. He does this to create a flat, feminine crotch. My patients have gender dysphoria. They are dissociated from their bodies. They have trauma, depression, anxiety, autism, eating disorders, and other mental health problems. Their suffering is intense, and they are convinced that relief will come only from testosterone shots, estrogen patches, and a surgeon's scalpel. Their parents' worry and anguish cannot be described. I've been asked to speak today about how gender ideology is a medical experiment on our children. To be more precise, the actual experiment is gender-affirming care that the American Psychiatric Association and our Health and Human Services tells me I must provide. It's an experiment because instead of psychotherapy that slowly and gently explores a child's difficulties and provides emotional healing, it calls for interference with normal development, followed by permanent and drastic alteration of her healthy body. There is no high-quality evidence that gender-affirming care leads to long-term positive outcomes or decreased suicides. While there is conclusive evidence of serious harm and lifelong suffering, gender-affirming care calls for unquestioning acceptance of a child's chosen identity, even though that identity contradicts reality. It means placing the child in the driver's seat, no matter how young or troubled he may be, allowing him to pick his name, his pronouns, his clothing, and his bathroom. This is all called social transition. Likewise, decisions to block puberty, to take cross-sex hormones, and undergo surgery are based on the child's or teenager's wishes. That is not practicing medicine. That is rubber stamping a child's self-diagnosis. Gender-affirming care is centered on two assumptions. First, that regarding gender, children and adolescents know best who they are and what they need. And second, that it is possible to be born in the wrong body. These beliefs have not been proven. There is no evidence that they are legitimate. Nevertheless, for the past 10 years, affirming care has been widely accepted in the US as the first-line treatment for gender dysphoria. This would not be accepted in any other area of medicine. Recently, Joe Biden and his Assistant Secretary of Health, Dr. Levine, advised parents that early hormone and surgical treatments are crucial for their gender-confused children. I very much doubt, however, that either the president or Dr. Levine realize that the foundation for the treatments they call crucial is a single study of only 55 subjects. Gender-affirming care is based on one small case study, a study that many authorities consider problematic. This is a complicated subject, but here's what you need to know.
Now, I'm going to leave it there for now, but let me just end off by saying this. For those tuning to the podcast all over the world, some of you might not be able to join us, but in a week's time, on the 9th of May, I am hosting a panel discussion here in Rondebosch, Cape Town, concerning the state of our children here in South Africa. And I've got it a mini title of The State of Our Nation, because our nation really is the young people. And we'll be discussing various legal matters regarding various rights issues with our very prominent guests that I've managed to pull together, which is amazing to have these guys all in the same room to share their knowledge. Like I said, I'm very big on legacy. But I'm going to be joined by Mari Sickers, who is known as Mari Bellable Sickers. And for those in South Africa, you will know what I'm talking about. The Bellable is trying to be pushed through in Parliament at the moment. And she, no one knows more about the Bellable and has been a vocal advocate against it, like Mari Sickers. And she's from the ACDP, which is one of our local national political parties here in South Africa, with Christian principles and values. And she is a vocal advocate against the Bellable. Then we are joined by, for those that are in the homeschooling areas scene of South Africa and are into homeschooling and homeschool your kids, he is very well known, Christopher Corderio. He's flying down from Joburg to be with us in Cape Town on the 9th of May. And he'll be discussing various topics, projects that they're involved in. He'll also touch on the Bellable and some of his community-based school projects. And just speaking his mind regarding homeschooling in general, he's part of the Petzolotsi Trust, and he's also the founder of Learn Free here in South Africa. Then we've got another member of Parliament who is very involved in legal matters in Parliament, Steve Swart. And he'll be speaking about the Bellable process. But his main thing will be, which is flying under the radar here in South Africa, is the WHO Pandemic Treaty and the amendments to our international health regulations regarding what the WHO can do if a pandemic is declared in your country. He'll also be touching on hate crimes and hate speech bill, and also the decriminalization of prostitution. He will be commenting and discussing all of these things. And then we have got from 4SA, from everyone in South Africa, you know who 4SA is. And Liesl Pretorius. Pretorius is the head of legal for 4SA, and she'll be joining us. And she's going to be dissecting the ECE toolkit, which is very much touching on what Miriam Grossman had to say regarding what they are going to be doing with our kids in school and the guidelines that teachers are being given regarding gender specifically and what to do with that relating to our kids. She'll also be speaking on freedom of religious expression and also on the hate crimes and hate speech bill, which they've been fighting against over the years. So that's a discussion you don't want to miss. For those that listen to this before the 9th of May, spread the word and bring a friend. Get hold of us at Frontline Fellowship. You can look it up on our website, frontline.org.za. And space will be limited for this live recordings panel discussion, but I do hope that you guys can join us for this State of Our Nation panel discussion on the 9th of May at 7 p.m. in the evening. And because I think Matt Walsh said this very, very well, I'm going to end off this podcast with a few words from Matt Walsh regarding the state of our children, not just for America, but we can take this home and bring this home to South Africa as well.
It is normal for a person to treat such behavior as bizarre and antisocial because it is bizarre and antisocial behavior. A lot of what we now refer to as bullying among children, some of it is actually bullying, but a lot of it is really just children acting normal and responding to weird, unhealthy things in a way that conveys that the things are weird and unhealthy. The schools want to condition children out of that natural, normal response. They want your child to treat the furry as normal. And then after treating the furry as normal, eventually to actually see this sort of behavior as normal. And then eventually to become one himself or something just as or more bizarre. That is the process. That's the agenda. And it's playing out at schools all across the country right now.
So thank you for everyone who has joined us this week for our edition of From the Front Line. And this is Vaughn, aka the Cyber Hitchhiker, who has been stepping into some big shoes with Dr. Hammond being away and Justin Ford. But we'll hopefully be back next week with something different, and maybe Justin will be in studio as well for us, with us next week. But for now, we are just going to say it has been awesome sharing the airwaves with you. Thank you for tuning into From the Frontline on the Podbean podcast platform. Thank you for visiting our websites, frontlinemissionsa.org, and supporting us throughout the years. Check out all of our resources that we've got available, all the audio recordings that we've got available, all the different topics that we discuss, and all the books that are available for you to purchase and to download for free. Go and have a look at everything, and we will catch you next time on From the Frontline. And this is Vaughn, aka the Cyber Hitchhiker, saying goodbye and God bless.